Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder of The New Health Club. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders, and disruptors creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. And we think that the future is already here. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of The New Health Club show. My guest today is Brian Murarescu. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Brown University with a degree in Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit, and he's been practicing law internationally for 15 years. In 2016, Murarescu became the founding executive director of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. Their work has been featured prominently in the media. In arbitration with the NFL in 2018, Murarescu represented the first professional athlete in the United States to seek a therapeutic use exemption for cannabis. So what brings the man on a podcast about psychedelics now? Well, Brian and I met in a very unusual place, yet very commonplace for 2020, a Zoom call. In my case, at midnight. The call had the title Faith and Delics and was about Jewish religion and psychedelics. Brian and me were not Jewish, but Catholic, so we were put in the Catholic breakout room with a pastor from the Midwest talking about psychedelics. This is where I learned about Brian's amazing book. He recently released The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name. The Immortality Key is a look into the psychedelic origins of the world's greatest spiritual practices, and what those might mean for how we view ourselves and the world around us. Brian researched for 12 years, and he was able to get in the archives of the Vatican and check if there are any psychedelic hints, which there were. He traveled Europe to find out how ancient rituals were supported by psychedelic experiences. So, did the ancient Greeks use psychedelic to find God? And did the first Christians inherit the same secret tradition? Brian's book and theories changed my whole idea of being Catholic. Plus, what if our cultures and religions were already based on psychedelic rituals and experiences, and what if we start to remember them? This is like a really interesting topic to me. And I mean, of course, as you can imagine, one could talk for days about this, maybe for weeks, for months. But we tried to talk to Brian in an hour about being Catholic and researching psychedelics. Please enjoy the show. Okay, so this is a very exciting episode for me with Brian. Do you say the C Murarescu or do you say only Brian Murarescu?
No one has said the C yet, but I'd be honored if you
okay.
did.
Okay, Brian C Murarescu. And first of all, before we talk about your amazing book and say the title, I would really like to say how we met because it's such a modern COVID, post-COVID, in COVID story. So we were on the call that was had the title Jews and Psychedelics, right? And so I think there were like 20 or 30 Jewish people, but only three Catholics, obviously. We were two of them, and we met in a Catholic breakout room besides like a pastor from Minnesota or Michigan. And suddenly three Catholics are on a call and should talk about psychedelics. And I just heard about your book like literally a couple of hours before. And I was even thinking like, oh, should I really go on this call? I'm already in my pajama. Like, okay, come on. And then it was like the most fascinating 12 a.m. midnight call with so many super interesting people. And this is where I learned about your book also, and which is called The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name, right? So that's the whole title.
That's it.
So, and of course, since we are a podcast which is based on the story and the whole industry of psychedelics, this is what we're going to mainly talk about today, which you kind of redefine, I would say, in your book, and how Christianity is rooted in psychedelic rituals. So Please tell us, how did you get to this topic at all? And how did you connect dots that were seemed to be very unconnected for a long time?
Well, thank you for having me. The short answer is it takes a long time. It took 12 years. Mm-hmm. And the longer answer is I grew up watching Indiana Jones in the 80s, the Da Vinci Code when I was in my 20s, and figured that was a pretty kick-ass job, but it's hard to get paid to do that kind of stuff. So in my case, despite geeking out on ancient languages for close to 8 years, I went to law school and sold out to Wall Street and, you know, just became a normal tax-paying citizen, but never left these mysteries behind. And so I was always fascinated by this crazy hypothesis from the 70s about the ancient Greeks maybe using drugs. I came out in 1978, an obscure little book called The Road to Eleusis, mm-hmm. which I think is less obscure today. But it was this really interesting idea that an LSD-type beer was consumed in what was essentially the ancient spiritual capital of Greece by the best and brightest of the time, from Plato to Aristotle to Marcus Aurelius, right? And the intriguing proposition that maybe whatever was happening there would be inherited by the earliest Greek-speaking Christians who, as a good Catholic, you know, we're all Greek speakers, right? Paul's letters are written in Greek to Greek speakers. And so mm-hmm. there's an, at least from the surface, there's a connection there. And this is called the pagan continuity hypothesis. And so I refer to my book as the pagan continuity hypothesis with a psychedelic twist. The idea being going out and trying to find the hard scientific data to actually prove that one way or the other. I mean, make that hypothesis like a real scientific hypothesis, make it observable, testable, repeatable, falsifiable. And the way you do that, amongst other things, in my opinion, is through archaeochemistry, which is looking into these ancient chalices, cups, vessels, testing them for organic contents and finding out if they really were spiked with drugs. And so I spent 12 years and came up with two hits that I present in the book, which we can talk about, which I think mm-hmm. establish a pretty compelling link between our ancient ancestors, drugs, and religion.
Yeah, just tell us about them, these two.
Sure. Let's cut right to the chase. Right to the chase. So this 1978 book, The Road to Eleusis, right? Mm-hmm. It's written by Gordon Wasson, Albert Hofmann, who is the first person to synthesize LSD, the brilliant Swiss chemist.
And Gordon Wasson, we should also say who that is, because it's a very important person, kind of being a banker before also, right? And just traveling to South America to have a mushroom experience.
Right.
I've always, short version.
That's a great version. I mean, he's the guy who put the psychedelics in the first psychedelic renaissance. I mean, he's the guy who went to Mexico in 1958 and, you know, rediscovers psilocybin-containing mm-hmm. mushrooms at this velada in Oaxaca, Mexico, under the tutelage of Maria Sabina. I mean, so we have Gordon Wasson to thank for all these trials at Hopkins and NYU, and everything that's happening with psilocybin today really starts in 1955, or at least for us, restarts in 1955. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. What he found there, he almost immediately suspected. I'm glad you mentioned him, because Gordon himself suspected after he had these really intense visions, which seemed to him more real than real, right? A phenomenon that happens again and again and again in these modern psilocybin trials, what they call the noetic sense, the sense that you've tapped into the ultimate nature of reality. The same thing mm-hmm. happened to Gordon, except that he didn't just take it at that. He immediately made the connection to Eleusis, which is what happened to me in 2007 when I started reading these psilocybin trials. It's funny. It was my very, very first reaction was something was happening there, partly thanks to Gordon, because Gordon is mentioned in the very first line of this article in The Economist, right? You don't expect to find, you know, drugs and God in The Economist. There was this amazing article, The God Pill, that I read, and it was published in 2006, and it mentions Gordon in the very first line. And I thought, this is the guy I was reading about, you know, a few years ago, the crazy mm-hmm. drug guy. And turns out he wasn't so crazy. So it was actually Gordon and his reference in that paper that got me re-exploring not just The Road to Eleusis, but I was reading everything you possibly could about drugs and religion, and came up, you know, a bit short because there wasn't much scientific data to prove it. So in their mm-hmm. book, they basically say that ergot, which is this naturally occurring fungus that ergot had somehow been used to spike this magical potion in Eleusis. I mean, for something like close to 2,000 years, which is crazy. And you know, it's hard to find data for that. So I was just scouring these archaeobotany journals, and I came across this phenomenal hit from 20 years ago. This team of Spanish archaeologists uncovered a site that could properly be called ancient Greek, or at least Hellenistic, very much influenced by the ancient Greeks and their mysteries. And what they found was a chalice, which tested positive for beer and for ergot. Yeah. It's the very first scientific data for the proposition that some kind of ergotized beer was actually drunk in antiquity. It's just incredible.
So, but Eleusis, the first time I heard about this is, I think, when Amanda Fielding told me about it, the great, you could say, grand dame of the first, second, maybe psychedelic renaissance. And I mean, it seemed that it was a place outside Athens or close to Athens, mm-hmm. where, I mean, basically all the philosophers we know, like Aristoteles, Socrates, all these guys went with the purpose was to have a psychedelic experience there and then come back with the, let's say, the death experience they had had in the psychedelic experience or the life and death experience. And then basically writing their works of literature or like philosophy after the influence of psychedelics. I mean, is this like a too simple way to look at it, that they went for the weekend to, I mean, I'm not going to say party, but to get high and have new ideas and come back and write the basic philosophy of the European culture, basically?
I think Carl Ruck might appreciate that description. So Carl is the third member of this trio. We talked about Gordon Wasson, Albert Hofmann, and Carl mm-hmm. Ruck, mm-hmm. at the time, was the youngest member of that trio in 1978, only a couple years older than me at the time. He's now 85 years old, and he's dedicated his whole life to trying to prove exactly what you just said. But the idea being, and part of the reason I studied Eleusis is because when you look at it, it wasn't quite a party scene. It was, you know, it was this really sacred affair. These initiates would march a half marathon, essentially, from Athens, northwest, all the way to Eleusis, twice. They would do it once and become like a first level initiate. And they do it a second mm-hmm. time a year later around the fall equinox and then become a full initiate. And it only happened once in your life. So again, something else that really struck me about the modern day psilocybin experiments, you know, people with one mm-hmm. and only dose of psilocybin, you know, basically calling it one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives, if not the most meaningful, these God type experiences, even amongst atheists. I mean, the basic thing that jumps out of you about Eleusis is that it was death and rebirth. There was something mm-hmm. transformative happening there. You mentioned Aristotle. About Eleusis, he says that the initiates went there not to learn something, mathein, which is where we get mm-hmm. mathematics, but to experience something, to suffer something, pathein,
okay,
like pathology. So some kind of experience. Wow. It wasn't mm-hmm. Something learned. Some kind of experience was happening.
Okay.
The controversy is whether or not drugs were involved. And the fact that we found this ergotized beer in Spain is really compelling. You know, we can't extrapolate out and say every single initiate for 2,000 years drank an LSD beer and died and you know, resurrected. But you know, there's a lot more, but we're just beginning, which is the fun part of this. I mean, we're just beginning to test these chalices. We're just beginning to really rewalk the sacred road to Eleusis.
I mean, like what you just, I mean, that's what I was thinking when I was reading the book and like listening to a podcast. So it seems that this is kind of the very beginning of a whole new perception of, first of all, religion in general, culture second, like the outcome that people experienced who wrote the basic like books for each culture. But I mean, of course, like growing up as a Catholic person or woman, so does it mean you have to completely reconsider your own religion, which would be very fascinating? Is this what you think that will happen in let's say in the next 10, 20 years?
depending on what that reconsideration looks like, I think religion, faith, and science too. Science. I mean, I think we should always be reconsidering. I mean, the great part about science is that you can wake up any day and be proven wrong, and that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, you should want to be proven wrong. Science lives and dies on the proposition that the next time a piece of evidence comes along to falsify everything you hold sacred is a good day, because it means progress. And I think religion, that's interesting, I think religion can exist in the same framework. And this notion that, you know, any faith, if untested, doesn't hold that much value. I mean, you know, so I dove into this rabbit hole quite ironically, because the Jesuits sent me there. You know, I was taught Latin and Greek by Jesuits. These were holy men.
Oh, okay, wow.
Holy men, you know, kind of enticing me into pagan mysteries. And I kind of, you know, I definitely went off on my own little hunt there. But at its root, it's the same thing that happened in Central Europe during the Reformation, which is trying to get back to the source of what Catholicism really is, right?
Well, I mean, this is something interesting. I heard, I think it was on a Joe Rogan podcast, like two things. First of all, that Santa Claus had something to do with psychedelics, but we can talk about this later. but I think in one podcast you said that, if I remember this correctly, that the Protestant movement took out certain herbs and certain potions or psychedelics out of the beer or out of the... the fluids that you actually took medication with or were just drinking. So can you talk about that? That basically the Protestant religion was kind of moving religion away from any kind of ecstatic, I don't know, experiences?
Yeah, and you can Google and find this stuff, actually. I mean, in my book, I say, you know, Google's not your friend. I mean, there are some things you can find, and there are some things you can, if you Google... hallucinogenic beer, psychedelic beer. I mean, choose your favorite terms. You'll find some really interesting stuff. So Christian Ungermeyer and I were talking about the Heinheitsgebot, these purity.
Yeah, of course. Sure.
So the purity laws from Germany, and I think it's 1516, they weren't about what to include in the beer. Because the purity laws essentially say that it can't be beer unless it's water, and, you know, barley.
Exactly. Yeah.
Humulus lupulus, which is the hop, right?
Oh, God. Yeah.
But it wasn't, the hops weren't always there. The reason that the purity laws came along is because it was kind of this Protestant backlash against these Catholic, potentially hallucinogenic beers. The Catholic Church had a monopoly on these infused beers, infused with all kinds of things like henbane and these weird things that pop up in the literature. And it harkens back to the same kind of LSD or ergotized beer that we found in Spain and beers across time. We're still building the archaeobotanical evidence for it, but I mean, the stark proposition is that ancient beer and ancient wine were routinely spiked with this stuff.
But I mean, this whole, how do you call it, botanical, how do you call it, what you said, botanical evidence, kind of?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is something that seems to, just before I got on a podcast this morning, I read this on Twitter, like how Monica Williams, a doctor she's researching, race-based trauma. And she was writing a blog post about certain substances and plants that actually were considered always under very racist in a racist context, and were actually, how could you say this? Like, actually, people would say, well, only black people use these kind of plants because they're so like magic, and so they're related to voodoo. So it seems that there's a whole kind of rethinking of so many kind of very, very stable ideas about our culture that is now just kind of getting researched, which is seems the kickoff to this seems to be also the psychedelic renaissance. But I mean, let's come back to this beer thing, because I think Germans will be very interested in this, that their beer once was LSD, basically. So let's say the situation is you're in Eleusis, you drink this beer, and do you have any research or theories what happened when you drank the beer? Did you, was it like a, like, let's say, related to a psilocybin experience, or was it a very different kind of, yeah, state of mind you were in?
See, that,
is there any
that,
research?
That is the question.
Okay.
And I still, yeah. I still don't have the answer. Because as you probably, and your audience probably knows, you know, ergolines, these ergot-derived alkaloids, yeah, like LSD and others, mm-hmm, they're very different from the classical hallucinogens, like DMT and psilocybin-containing, mm-hmm, species. We know, or at least we think, there was this death and rebirth experience, right? Mm-hmm. Now, how an ergotized beer would play is not entirely clear to me. As anyone knows, that when you start looking up ergot, you find lots of funky things. As a matter of fact, in German, they have very colorful words for ergot, which ought to tell you about the experience, like Tolkorn and Totenkorn. Mm-hmm. These are not,
oh, okay,
these
the
are
corn,
not fun,
yeah,
experiences, mm-hmm, when you're drinking Tolkorn. That's crazy corn in English. So mm-hmm, this stuff was known, especially in the Middle Ages, for, you know, fits of hallucinations and outbreaks of convulsions and potentially gangrene. I mean, it's not a fun experience. So whatever that ergotized potion was, if there was an ergotized potion at Eleusis, they must have, there must be some chemical genius behind it to produce the right kind of experience that we would associate with, like, psilocybin today, for example. And I still don't know what that is. I talk to all kinds of chemists who have ideas about, mm-hmm, what that could, mm-hmm, be. And folks are always pointing me towards LSA, lysergic acid amide, instead of LSD. Mm-hmm. It's a possibility. Whatever was happening was profound, was life-changing, and Ruck says the culminating experience of a lifetime.
But aren't you also fascinated by the idea that so many decisions, like war decisions, religious decisions, must have been made under the influence of this, let's call it LSD beer? I mean, this is like something, if you really think what certain decisions, like, for example, in times of Alexander the Great, I'm just saying this because my name is Filippi and it's from this town in Macedonia.
That's right. That's
but right. I mean, I always try to imagine, like, after reading this, how the political decision-making was maybe also influenced by psychedelic potions, which we don't know yet. Maybe,
or if not, actually, right, as a Philippos, as a Philkipos, a horse lover, as a horse lover.
Yeah, exactly.
In the ancient times, I mean, it wasn't just psychedelic substances per se. And this is always the point I come back to about Christianity too. What we can say is visionary experiences, whether drug induced or not, whether drug facilitated or not. I mean, you think about, like, you said state decisions, and I was thinking about the Oracle at Delphi. I mean, we know like very bureaucratic, like the approvals of state constitutions in Sparta were sent to a prophetess who was supposed to be communicating the words of a god. And this is how they ratified constitutions. I mean, this stuff, and it wasn't just at Delphi. And I talk a lot about the pre-Socratics in my book. We've been focusing on Plato and classical Athens, but I cite the scholarship of this incredible his historian, scholar, prophet, Peter Kingsley, who writes about the pre-Socratics, like Parmenides, Empedocles, Pythagoras. And what they were doing were these incubation techniques. I mean, this ancient Greek meditation of going into dark places. In fact, his book, In the Dark Places of Wisdom, is like spectacular. So that they were going into these caves or lairs, or even in Pythagoras's case, his basement. He built, you know, a chamber in his basement in Italy to lie down still and motionless and enter into these trance states. And if you extrapolate that out far enough, I mean, Kingsley would say that these are the sacred roots of Western civilization. This is where democracy, the arts and sciences, and the university comes from, is from these trance states, you know, these mystical states.
So meaning, it sounds like what you're describing could be from the Netflix show from Chelsea Handler, where she goes on an ayahuasca experience, lying on her alone in a room, like on a back, and just having experiences that lead you to decision-making, right? I mean, this would be like the core structure of how psychedelics were used also, maybe.
I think, I like that, how they were, I mean, however they were used, there seems to be a purpose behind it. And you know, I use the word ritual.
Exactly. Yeah.
I use the word ritual in the book copy. I call this some of the first evidence for the ritual use of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. You know, especially that beer in Spain. It's just it's full of ritualistic elements. You know, incense being burned and dogs being sacrificed and women mixing beer. I mean, it wasn't just a random cup in a random place. I mean, this stuff was
exactly
just like Adelusis. There was a lot of ceremony and thought. And methodology that, I mean, like a science of spirituality, if you want to call it that.
Well, I mean, since you're a Catholic too, so I mean, if I think about my history as a Catholic person, like you have, like the earliest memories are the ones with the, when I was like 7 or 8, I think, and the ceremonies were so powerful, mostly when the priest was going around with this, how you call this, it's also a corn. If you set it on fire, like in Germany, it's Weihrauch.
Frankincense.
And then like the whole church was like this, and then so there were already moments of, kind of when you think about this from today, it's really like wow, there was a very special kind of spiritual enhancement in these moments. And it was not just like you go to church, you listen to somebody, you go out. And then also if you start the Holy Communion and you get trained for this and you put on you're marrying Jesus of all people, like in this white dress. And it's like a year of preparing for a ceremony. And I mean, if you look at it from today, it feels like that this part of religion is, for most people, the part that they wanted to get rid of because it's maybe too difficult to experience in the way that you could be manipulated. And, you know, like the whole, like, for example, in Germany, it's a lot of times when people become grown-ups, they leave the church not to pay taxes anymore. So because they say, I don't want to pay for the Catholic Church. And so, but still, then when you're older again, like you kind of start to think about these rituals from your childhood, that they were actually very strong, these rituals. Mm. And you forget about the rational part and why Rome is so dangerous and what the Catholic Church did and everything. So how was your personal relation to being raised as a, I guess, Catholic boy and in the whole spiel of religion?
That's a good one. I mean, if anything, like, I mean this, I became more intrigued by my faith. I went to 13 years of Catholic school, including those 4 years with the Jesuits. I mean, you know, when you start talking about incense and the ritual and the formula, I mean, I'm taking back to, I'm not sure if they do it in Germany, but the Stations of the Cross is a thing in the United States during Lent, where you're standing, sitting, kneeling, chanting, standing, kneeling, sitting, chanting. I mean, the frankincense just going crazy. I mean, we do it for some reason in the basement of my parish church, and kids would pass out routinely. There's a lot of weird stuff to send an 8-year-old through, you know? And then when I received the body of Christ, literally, right? The body, I ate the body of Christ when I was eight years old. And I remember memorizing all these questions and answers and being interviewed by the priest and dressing up in the white shoes. Who puts white shoes on an 8-year-old? But when you think about it, there's some thought there, which is why the pagan continuity hypothesis is so interesting, right? We do find incense and all these aromatic herbs and these spiked wines and plants used in antiquity in the pagan traditions. I read a lot about the connection between Dionysus and Jesus and the possibility that these spiked potions could have made their way from pagan Dionysus to Christian Jesus. And when you look at the Catholic Mass, I think I quote a line in the book from like 1918. Preserved Smith says, when you're looking at the Mass, you are you're looking at something of hoary antiquity. The idea that it's hard to walk into a Catholic church and not be transported back in time.
It's true.
And I don't mean 2,000 years ago. I mean several thousand years ago, because what's happening there is it could be the engine of civilization.
Yeah, but also, like, I think the more I think about this, like the rituals, even if you remember them from your childhood, they kind of never leave you, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. But they're rituals that you don't experience anymore today. And so I feel that a lot of people who are drawn to, let's say, psychedelic experiences, a big part of this is just that they really enjoy the ritual of preparing. For example, I went to synthesis, and then like on Saturday after your vegan lunch, you prepare your own tea, because also legally you have to do it because nobody else can prepare it for you. But there's somebody who shows you, and there are 12 people, I mean, for COVID, who preparing their tea, like kind of crushing the mushrooms, put them in a tea and everything. And it's like nobody talks. It's really like in a church, basically. Oh. And now then the tea is brought to you to your place where you're going to lie down. But it's like a total ritual situation. And everybody's just like, whoa, this is something I don't experience anymore. So I find that super interesting, because I think that this whole fascination for the new psychedelics has a lot to do with re-experiencing rituals that people are really craving, actually. And I read even a book this year saying that if there's a complete lack of rituals in people's lives, this will lead to depression.
Wow.
So, and I don't know, this is like really far away now from the whole thing, but I think it's all like a whole new look how to perceive the world in a very different way, I think, these days. But I mean, of course, we have to talk how you went to the Vatican, to the archive of the Vatican, which is, I never heard of this, that anybody figured this out. So tell us about how you researched psychedelics in the Vatican archive.
Right. So again, you know, in my kind of evidence-based attempts to go through these mysteries, mm-hmm. part of it mm-hmm. is looking at the hard science. And we have these interesting hits that we talked about, you know, the LSD type beer and the spiked wine that we turned up in Pompeii. And I was looking mm-hmm. for more data in the Middle Ages and things like that. It's hard to come by. And I thought what I could at least do is walk into the Vatican and try and find some evidence in their own handwriting for the existence of a tradition that may have survived from antiquity. And I mm-hmm. reconstruct this potential timeline from, you know, the early Gnostics, these heretics of the church, to folks for whom the pagan continuity stayed in place. You know, I always like to say that the world didn't become Christian one day. I mean, it took centuries and centuries in the Roman Empire, and there were holdouts. Mm-hmm. You know, there were still pagan type practices and incubation happening in Italy, for example, in the wake of the fall of the Roman Empire. I mean, so for centuries, this stuff was still there, all these pagan traditions. And I follow them into the High Middle Ages and witchcraft and this notion of traditional medicine. And obviously, because a lot of my book is about women preparing these potions, I wanted to see if there was evidence for that. So I went into the Vatican secret archives, which is not easy to do. And I was reviewing a manuscript, basically the indictment against Giordano Bruno, perhaps the most notorious wizard, warlock, mm-hmm. Ever mm-hmm. detained and eventually executed by the Catholic Church in 1600. And there's some interesting language there about his views on the Eucharist. We don't have all the details, but clearly his views on the Eucharist, which he called idolatry. He was an unbeliever in whatever the transubstantiation was being bandied about in the 16th century. So it was at least part of the reason that he was targeted by the church. So I didn't find anything in the Vatican secret archives, but mm-hmm. what I did find is a good friend there, an archivist, who led me into the direction of the Archive of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, which is a mouthful, but it's where Pope Benedict used to work mm-hmm. before becoming mm-hmm. Pope. It's a hard line corner of the church, just to the west of St. Peter's. It's this beautiful saffron bricked building where they have the files of the Inquisition, which is
wow.
from the actual trials. And what I was interested in is finding evidence for the use of these things, whatever that is, the drugs, compounds, mixtures by women. And I found some things. I mean, thanks to an Italian scholar, he led me on the path, and I was sitting there paging through this 16th century manuscript, looking at a woman named Lucrezia, who was targeted by the Inquisition in Tuscany for mixing up wine with ivy, mixing up a special incense and spiking it with her own blended magical herbs, stealing the Eucharist from the church and repurposing it for God knows what purposes, and boiling up some kind of weird unguent in which lizards were the active compound. I mean, so, you know, right there in the Vatican, you know, in black and white, in their penmanship, evidence for the use of some kind of funky tradition.
So that sounds like witches created psychedelics. I mean, it sounds like a proper witch profile you're describing.
That's what, if you ask like the specialist, that's what they'll say. They might not say witch, but I talked.
No, I mean, today they would say witches.
But, yes, but it's true. This I was in Munich talking to Martin Zarnkow about this, one of the world's top beer scientists. And he says that women were the brewers.
Okay.
I mean, before industrialization, women were brewing the beer. Women were mixing the wine. If you look at any ancient vase, I have several in my book, but you see women adding the ingredients. So this was the woman's job. And it seemed to stay that way through the mysteries, through the Dark Ages, into the Middle Ages, and the early modern period. And during the Inquisition, the sacred pharmacology of the West, I'll call it, is stamped out. It survives in the New World. And I finish my book by talking about peyote and ololuqui and these sacraments that survived in the Americas. But in Europe, a lot of this knowledge, I mean, really did disappear for lots of different reasons, but the Inquisition, certainly among them.
But I mean, this kind of, you would say, healer or this shaman, Maria Sabina, she was also like the woman who gave the mushrooms to Gordon Wasson. She was a very, very highly looked upon, like untouchable, you could say, like very old. How old was she? Like in her 70s, I think, right? Shaman, basically.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting how in the ayahuasca context, this seems to be more women still involved. But I mean, in the psychedelic industry, not so much. So, but let's see. I mean, this might change too. But I mean, I love this one thing you said, like the first temple was the first bar. Mm. So this, I love this because it's so, you immediately have like an image from Indiana Jones when he comes to a temple where there's a bar. So can you talk a little bit about this image, how you kind of researched around this, how this idea came together?
Yes, and the Germans, once again, are all over this stuff. I mentioned to Christian too. I mean, you can't go very far in this journey without bumping into a German. It's the okay. German Archaeological Institute, perhaps the premier institution in the world for this kind of research, archaeological research. They've been excavating this temple in southern Turkey on the border with Syria. I'm sure folks have heard of it, Göbekli Tepe. If you just look up Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, you'll see, I think it was the Smithsonian who dubbed it the world's first temple, which I love. And I threw in the world's first bar because this same German, Martin Zarnkow, tested some of these giant limestone troughs and barrels back in about 10 years ago. They published it in 2012. What he found were the initial indications of calcium oxalate, which is beer fermentation. So we think, and there's more data coming out on this soon, But we think that there was big vats of beer being brewed at this temple 12,000 years ago, at the moment when we go from hunting and gathering to settled agricultural life. It's called the Agricultural Revolution. It just may be possible, I say in the book, that it's the beer revolution, that beer was the engine for civilization, as I mentioned earlier. The idea that drugs and religion go hand in hand. I mean, beer, if it was there and we're brewing beer before we're baking bread, which is part of the argument. If we're brewing beer, it doesn't mean it was like some pastime. It means it was a sacrament in the fullest sense of the word. And based on reconstructions of everything else that was happening at Göbekli Tepe, like ecstatic dancing, says the German Archaeological Institute, a skull cult. They found skulls with holes drilled into them. They thought skulls were being hung from these megalithic pillars. I mean, if all this stuff is happening and beer is at the middle of it, I mean, it wasn't just a party. Again, it's not just a party drug. It's some kind of ceremony, what the Germans say, for the living to interact with the dead. It's for the living mm-hmm. to, it was a pilgrimage site for them. And for some reason to find contact with, I mean, we say the gods today, they would have understood that as the ancestors, the immortal ones. The Greeks and the Romans had the same idea that our dead, that human dead people, when they cross over, become gods, become immortals, and you can contact mm-hmm. them to find knowledge. I mean, really, really spooky stuff.
So, I mean, but this is also something very important in your book, that the state between life and death, or like death per se, like looked upon very differently than we look at it today. You talk a lot about this, but also like it's interesting how people have in a psychedelic experience, they kind of, you could say, I mean, they die as the person who they don't no longer want to be, which I had that experience. And then they see themselves as the person that they know they actually are, but they just couldn't see that person before. So, and when I had a guided LSD experience, and this is exactly what happened to me after 5 minutes. And I mean, I kind of died as the person who was no longer interesting for me. And I came back as a pregnant woman with twins and Jewish and whatnot. So I was a completely different thing. So can you talk a little bit about that topic in your book, like this life and death kind of rearrangement of the ideas that we have about this?
I start the book with a beautiful phrase that one of the craziest things that's happened since the book was published is a cool guy sent me a picture of his arm on which he tattooed this phrase. Mm-hmm. So this is a thing now. It's an ancient Greek. It's an pethanis prin pethanis denta pethanis otan pethanis. It's this beautiful phrase from St. Paul's monastery on Mount Athos in Greece. And it means, if you die before you die, you won't die when you die. That's kind of the whole theme of the book. I mean, and that, by the way, is the immortality key. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily drugs or a drug-facilitated mystical experience. It's that die by any means before your actual death. And there's this sense that you found eternity, that you've acquainted yourself with the other side when it matters, which is here and now. And that could be a near-death experience. That could be some other kind of spontaneous mystical experience. It could be laying down in your closet for 3 days. It could be fasting. Sure. All these archaic techniques of ecstasy. But the one common thing you see, which is why I wrote so much about it in my intro, is that dying to the self, at least the way the mystics talk about it, is the path towards finding the self. And that only by dissolving who you think you are, that sense of the ego, and to the point where it's Bill Richards at Hopkins says, it has to be acutely and terrifyingly real, right? You have to believe you are dying. Everything that you think you are has to disappear. And in its wake, you wake up pregnant with twins. It's magic.
And it's the best experience. I mean, it's a very, very positive experience. And I mean, it's hard to maybe to talk about this, like, because people would say, well, I don't want to see myself dying or anything. But it's not like the idea we have of the actual death or something. It's just like, it's a very different experience. But I mean, if somebody very Catholic reads your book, so they just basically would totally have to review their ideas about their own religion. I mean, you really can say that because it's profoundly researched. You researched it for like 12 years. You were working on it. And I was thinking immediately, so like, let's say 10 years fast forward, you're the new Catholic philosopher and like scientist and whatnot. So, but do you think there could be something like a new kind of, like almost like a situation like in, what's the movie, The Name of the Rose, where the Catholic Church tries to keep away the new knowledge coming through? Because I can really imagine that really high profile Catholic, like even priests, like bishops or like the Pope. I mean, the Pope seems to be pretty open-minded. I hope he's still there. He's from South America when he's going to read your book. But do you ever think there will be like a new movement where the church tries to make this new knowledge, which I think would be a big change, I mean, in this whole idea of being Catholic? Do you think this will ever be possible, that this will be happening, or is this no longer possible these days?
I think it's very possible. And I didn't,
it is,
you know, I don't,
yeah.
I don't present this book. I don't talk about it. And as you're about to hear right now, I try and use very diplomatic language when I refer to this book and the role of the church in history, by the way. I mean, a lot of this is just truth and reconciliation when it comes to the role of women in the church. Has nothing to do with with today's leadership or the Pope or the cardinals or the hierarchy of today's church at the Vatican and elsewhere. It has nothing to do with that. It's trying to show the evidence for a different kind of Christianity, which is what any reform movement really is in its roots. There's this concept of ad fontes, getting back to the source. I mean, if drugs, it's a big if, right? That's why we're using science. If drugs were used, psychedelics in particular, by some Greek-speaking communities at some point in the early days of the faith, in paleo-Christianity, then it ought to mean something for today. And I had a long, brilliant conversation with Andrew Sullivan, who's a writer, a blogger, a journalist here in the States, and a fellow Catholic. And we talked for an hour and a half about this. And at the end of it, he says, well, you're not saying anything very revolutionary at all, are you? And I think the answer, no, I'm not. I'm not claiming that every single cup of the Eucharist was spiked with drugs. It's not quite that, you know, that Da Vinci Code shift. What I'm saying is that there is no one form of Christianity. I mean, psychedelics and Christianity are already married in the Native American church with peyote or with the Santo Daime and ayahuasca. So it's already happening. All I'm saying is that it wasn't just the Native Americans and people in the Amazon. I mean, in Europe, there seems to be a tradition that we've just forgotten.
Yeah, but I mean, I have this Roman Catholic background, and there is a very clear idea of how Catholics should be and how this works. There's no room for interpretation whatsoever. So, but I mean, but this is, I mean, before we come back to your personal idea about this. So, I mean, but this is happening also in other religions. Like we said earlier, very shortly, there's an article in Double Blind recently, what's called Lechaim Psilocybin, which was a great article from one of the editors, describing exactly also that, like, Judaism also is getting closer to their spiritual and meaning psychedelic experiences. But I mean, so you, I mean, I heard this in a Joe Rogan podcast that you kind of wanted to stay away a little bit from this, from your personal experience, to focus on the scientific point of view. But now you're basically free to go, right? Now you can experiment with everything.
That's what everyone keeps saying. Now I'm free.
Yeah.
To do as many drugs.
So what is your first adventure going to be like?
I mean, the peer
what do you
pressure,
think?
The peer pressure is just, it's
insanely high.
It's intolerable.
Yeah.
It's intolerable, especially from the Germans.
Yeah.
It's coming. It's coming. I still think we're at a moment where this topic is generally filtering its way into the conversations that ought to take place at the world's leading universities and laboratories. And we know that the psychopharmacology has been doing its thing for, in the modern iteration, 20 years. And it seems kind of crazy that we're not quite there yet, but we're on the precipice of something. You see what happened in Oregon, right? With regulating psilocybin for therapeutic purposes. People expect the FDA, for example, to approve psilocybin for one clinical condition or another. I say in the book, perhaps within the next 5 years. We are on the cusp of a drastic change in mental health care. We know that. I'm close to my experience. I don't think we're quite there yet. Just give me a couple of days here. There's something broken.
Okay. But what do you fancy? What drug do you fancy? Like, just from hearing about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my answer is almost definitely psilocybin. For a million reasons, for a bit, mainly because of all the research. I mean, number one, it's why I went down this rabbit hole. I think they've developed at Hopkins, NYU, and elsewhere. There's this protocol. I mean, just, you know, it's almost stupidly obvious. They've developed some kind of protocol where three and four people exit saying they've had this transformative mystical experience. And I think it has to do with the way they screen their patients. And I think it has to do with the way that they lead these volunteers through this experience, develop this trust. I think that's a big part of it. What I would like to see is some of our if not Catholic, then some of our sacred, you know, element, the things that I remember from childhood. I would love for some incense to be burned. When I smell frankincense, it's probably the same for you. When I smell frankincense, yeah, it takes me right back to being a kid. I would love for frankincense to be all over that room.
I even have like the muscle memory that my knees start to hurt because you were kneeling, wow, like you described, on this wood bench. Wow. And like, if I do a yoga pose, that's the first thing my brain, where I'm kneeling, like in child's pose, like my brain says, well, you know that from kneeling on the wood bench, that was very painful for like half an hour.
Wow. So, I know exactly what you're talking about. Exactly.
This is why we were at the Catholic breakout room. But I mean, so this seems to be what's so interesting with your book. It seems like, talked about this quickly earlier, that it's also the start. I mean, we have the psychedelic industry, we have the companies like Atai and Compass who are working on the products or like the medication and the tools to really help people with mostly treatment-resistant depression. But I think you started also kind of a movement where like the whole cultural review of this, of the idea of mental health or the idea of, yeah, like ritual, like including ritual in your daily life. Mm. So, and I mean, I'm sure you probably won't be the only one, the last one to kind of engage in this kind of rethinking, religion and ritual. So, are there any plans, what you would like to, I mean, if whatever you can talk about, what's your next research would be with this? Like, what is the thing you would like to focus on after this?
I'm not sure what I can mention, but I will say.
No, I mean, just what you, have, whatever
in,
you can
in
say.
In broad strokes, there's lots of initiatives in the works, yeah, involving some of the country's leading institutions and including sister, mm-hmm, institutions around the world, who I think ought to be taking a look at psychedelics for lots of reasons, but because psychedelics are this weird thing. They're like, they're a lens to study knowledge. They're a lens to study consciousness, and they're a lens, mm-hmm, to study the human condition. And what I mean by that is that you can take something like psychedelics, but you can involve like 20 disciplines pretty easily. Not just the, mm-hmm, archaeochemistry that I talk about in the book or the ethnobotany, not just, you know, theology and divinity studies and biblical studies, not just history and classics and linguistics, not just biochemistry and molecular therapeutics, not just paleoanthropology, but everything. I mean, you know, everyone can have a seat at the table when it comes to psychedelics. And at its root, we're really talking about how to revolutionize the sciences and the humanities, which was the goal of the Renaissance, by the way. Is to encourage the full spectrum study of all of life's mysteries. And you know, I haven't taken them, but when you look at the literature on psychedelics and the history, again, they just jump out as this prism to involve all these academics, all these great minds and experts. And my hope is that by combining all these resources, maybe we can not just take psychedelics forward, but the way we do science forward, or the way we think about medicine, or the way we think about religion. I really do think that we're living through a transformative decade where mental, mm-hmm, health, mm-hmm, medicine, and religion do not look the same in 2030 as they do right now in 2020.
Absolutely. And before we go, I mean, this one thing I think you explained it to in one of your talks, like this whole story where Moses saw the burning bush, which is like, if you think about it, reading it in the Bible in your studies as a child, it was always like, okay, but how could the sea divide? How could he see this bush? Like, so like thinking about this in your context means there were some substances involved where Moses was ready to get messages, what he was supposed to do. Again, like a political situation. Should he take his people out of the country?
Well, that's interesting. Another political. That's it. I never thought about, yeah, that. Another political determination. Yeah, he consulted the oracle, or maybe the oracle found him. Who knows? It's again another hypothesis worth investigating. The one that pops up a lot is the acacia bush, which is rich in DMT.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that was responsible for Moses' visions. I mean, it's not just the all the way through the Old Testament. And I mean, talk about the prophetic books there. You know, Paul never met Jesus. He wrote more than half the books of the New Testament, and he never met Jesus. He communicates through Jesus supernaturally through these hallucinatory experiences. He says, he talks about being caught up in the third heaven. Peter in Acts is explicitly described as being in a trance. I mean, so again, whether drugs are involved or not, visionary mystical experiences are at the roots of Judaism and Christianity. I mean, I don't think any serious scholar would debate that. The conversation is, what does that mean for us? I mean, what does that really mean for us? Now, if drugs, under the most controlled conditions possible, right? And again, I haven't done them. Under the most controlled, responsible, sacred conditions possible, if it can recreate the kind of charisma, the kind of enthusiasm that was happening in the early church, maybe it's something we can look at today as a tool to re-enchant a younger generation that has largely lost their faith. Not every Sunday by any means, but maybe once in your life, like Eleusis, maybe sparingly.
Yeah, but I mean, another thing in this kind of new psychedelic thing is also that more and more CEOs are doing this to make different decisions than without the experience, or they come in the decision. I mean, they're already kind of not going to say companies, but certain coaches that you could do this with as a, let's say, CEO who says, okay, we have this problem with the company. And I actually know somebody who does this for very high-end German entrepreneurs. And they, for example, they literally called him when COVID hit and was like, okay, I have no idea what we're going to do. I need you to take me on the psychedelic journey so I will get new ideas. And I'm not even making this up. It's already happening. So, I mean, Elon Musk and people like that, they always talk about this anyway. And people like Joe Rogan and other entrepreneurs. But I mean, it's already happening that some rather visionary people make decisions based on their psychedelic experience. Hmm. So it's not even something super crazy if you want.
Well, so. I don't think so.
Tesla was made because of an experience Elon Musk had with ayahuasca.
Yeah, I wish we all had Elon Musk's intuition or Joe Rogan's.
Now you know why they have them.
Steve Jobs, too. Steve Jobs talks openly about his psychedelic experience.
Apple.
It seems to, I mean, in those cases, these are people for whom it worked, right? I don't want to give the impression that we can all do LSD and wake up Elon Musk. I would love to think that we could. But, you know, there's something very special happening with those people. The general phenomenon is something that I do think can be scaled in a very, very safe, controlled way for a lot of people that just isn't available today.
And do you think you will ever call the Pope and say, I want to give you this book and take a look? I mean, he seems open-minded, kind of.
What will I say? I'll say that he's the first Jesuit to ever occupy that position, which to me is personally meaningful.
He's from Argentina.
He's from just over this way here.
Around the corner.
I'm in South America myself. I think, again, because of the way that I try to talk about this, I think I would love for this to be an inclusive conversation. I've talked to lots of priests already and rabbis, and at least the folks that I'm talking to, again, because I open myself to being proven wrong and being told that my language isn't quite correct. And when folks correct me, I'm happy to take it. What interests me is the conversation. It's not even a debate. It's what interests me is dialogue, conversation, about the roles of these substances, not just in antiquity, but in the future. And for that reason, because I think this could be a benefit to the church and a benefit to all organized religion, I would hope that Pope Francis would engage the conversation.
I'm sure he would. But one thing just came to my mind what we just said. And I mean, I once had to do a story about Berghain, which is this kind of infamous club here where people do a lot of drugs and go there over the whole weekend. And I got into a taxi to drive there, and I had to go there Sunday afternoon because there was a special time to do the story at that time. And then the taxi driver said to me, oh, so you're going to church So, and I was like, no, I'm going to Berkeley. He said, yeah, that's what I mean. So, and like we talked about this, and he said that he drives a lot of people around that time of Sunday between 11 and 2. Oh. So, and he said that his impression is that this has replaced going to church on Sundays. So people are obviously looking for rituals again, or for like things that can replace church once they grew up Catholic, or maybe if they grew up in a Jewish religion, they're looking for replacements for going to the synagogue or something. I mean, it seems that it's much more deeper rooted than we think it is.
Yeah, and that's another point. I mean, it's already happening. You know, it's on the therapeutic, it's whatever is happening in Oregon is already happening. Whatever is happening at that church is already happening. It's the reason I got involved in cannabis advocacy. I mean, you can't pretend this stuff doesn't exist. And so even though I haven't had it and I don't recommend that people do it, and I do think that these are powerful substances that need to be respected, they're out there. People are already engaging in their psilocybin churches and their cannabis churches. So, I mean, shouldn't we, you know, be talking honestly about it, openly trying to educate people about how dangerous this stuff can be, or how meaningful? Mm-hmm. I mean, really is what I want to talk about, is how meaningful these things can be based on the literature that I see in the clinical setting. So because it's already happening and these churches and the urge is already there, I would love to steer the conversation in a way that everybody can weigh in, not just the folks at the morning in the cab.
Okay. That was, I mean, as you see, we could go on for another 5 hours easily, what comes to your mind. But it was a great overview, what your research is about. And I really think everybody should read this book, because it's one of the most revolutionary books since Michael Pollan. Because I think these two books now really, really say or can portray the direction that we're moving towards too, I think.
Oh, thank you.
So... No, of course. I mean, to me, it's a very revolutionary thought. Like once I got my mind or my head around what this could mean, that things were actually different than I learned them, still I was attracted to certain things in that religion, even it wasn't a very beneficiary religion for me. Like, you know, the woman was either Virgin Mary or the prostitute. There was no other role to play. So, which leads us to the movie Belle de Jour, like done by a Catholic director called Luis Buñuel. So there are all these kind of like things you don't really think of while you're in it, but later on you kind of connect the dots. So you connected new dots that, I think are very interesting to me.
Thank you. I'd be happy to keep talking anytime you want.
Okay, perfect. Enjoy your sunshine in Uruguay.
Thank you. Not bad. Not bad.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Don't show it. So, Brian, it was amazing to talk to you. And again, like everybody should read the book. I'm absolutely convinced. And I hope you have a wonderful day in Montevideo, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. I mean it.
Thank you.